This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the outside of Luka Modric's right foot. Is there anything more beautiful? Real Madrid were on their way out of the Champions League after a quite brilliant Chelsea comeback before that glorious cross into the path of Rodrigo. After that, Karim Benzema sealed the win for Ancelotti's men, Chelsea paying the price for some missed chances and a poor first half in the first leg. Also, Villa and Real. Scenes in the Allianz, two shots on target over the two legs and two goals for Unai Emery's players, but no one could say they didn't deserve it. A wonderful goal late on, silencing the crowd in Munich. Elsewhere, we'll talk to Nick Ames, who's been to cover Dynamo Kyiv's first game since Russia's illegal invasion began. We'll talk a bit more Ten Hag to Manchester United, ask if Northern Ireland's women lost to England because, as their manager suggested, they just got a bit emotional about the whole thing. We've got some more pub graffiti, live show etiquette, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. James says, which member of the panel is most likely to break the law and not resign? The instant answer would be Barry Glendening. But I think, Barry, you have honour. I think if you did make a terrible mistake, you would resign.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I occasionally break the law, but I'm generally quite law-abiding. You know, if I'm driving, I keep within the speed limit. I don't park illegally. I would say my only regular law infraction is the odd after-hours pint in my local pub, and I don't think that's a resigning matter. But if you want me to stand down, Max...
Well, that is quite literally breaking lockdown. Almost, it's having a lockdown, I suppose.
No, that's it's a lock-in.
Yeah, exactly. It's having a lockdown, having a lock-in. But that's kind of what Boris did.
Well, no, I didn't set foot in a pub during the pandemic, and I followed the rules pretty much to the letter of the law. What I'd like to know, Max, is if I was caught bang to rights doing something illegal and embarrassing, and that was a resigning matter, and I lied through my teeth about it, would you go on a series of breakfast television shows sycophantically licking my boots and saying that, actually, I haven't really done anything wrong, and it's important that I continue in the Football Weekly family because we have important work to do.
I don't really want to be the Grant Chaps in all of this, to be brutally honest. I must confess, Lars Sivertsen, welcome, by the way, that I did...
It's very interesting hypotheticals you're stipulating here, Barry.
I did... at least twice go for more than one-hour walk outside during lockdown. So maybe it's my turn to fall on my sword.
Everybody. I was about to say, maybe that's like my Scandinavian background or whatever, but I did actually follow the lockdown rules. Whenever they were like, oh, we were all doing it, I was like, what? No. But I did actually walk the dog for longer than I was allowed to. And there were a few times when, like, I saw other dog walkers in the distance, and we moved, like, maybe slightly closer to each other on the path than we should have ideally been. I mean, we had a strict sort of one on one side of the path, one on the other side of the path, so we were a few yards away from each other. I do wonder if only to allow other walkers to pass by us, maybe there was an infraction in terms of distance. There might have been a bubble violation there. I'm not sure. But aside from that...
Already the Totally Football Show are going on Good Morning Britain to say Sivertsen must resign and Glendening has to go. Anyway, let's get to the football. Real Madrid 2, Chelsea 3. Pete says, did Real want it more or was it a case of Chelsea losing their Kulusevski? Danny says, what was more pleasing to you, Max? Looking into the eyes of your newborn son or the Modric through ball? He still isn't tired from 2018, by the way. And Rob says, which part of Barry's foot would Luka Modric use if he was to attempt a repeat of that pass? I mean, Sid... that moment was just beautiful.
It was classic Modric as well. At the weekend, Real Madrid beat Getafe 2-0 and Vinicius provided this really lovely, lovely cross for a Casemiro goal with the outside of his right foot. And immediately everyone in Spain said, oh, a bit of Luka Modric is wearing off on you because what Modric did last night isn't new. He uses the outside of his foot so well. In fact, there was even, this was one of the kind of the, if you like, the comedy lines that was held against Rafa Benitez. that Rafa Benitez had apparently told Luka Modric, look, this outside the foot thing, you should probably stop doing it. It's not a particularly effective way of kicking the ball. Now, I suspect, to be perfectly honest with you, that that story has been hammed up a bit, but it certainly is true that Benitez was uneasy about it. And then when Zidane came in, Zidane was asked for it, and Zidane kind of, and you know, we're talking about Zidane here, somebody who's quite good at playing football. Zidane kind of cooed over Modric. He's like, oh, the way that he hits the ball with the outside of his foot, I just love to watch this happen. So it wasn't hugely surprising when he did it last night. It was just glorious.
Is Lars, is he the best ever? I think Ricardo Quaresma obviously seemed to only have an outside of a right foot. I'm trying to think, is there anyone else who has an outside of the foot that's that beautiful?
Yeah, I mean, you're right to bring up Quaresma, but I think the crucial difference is that Modric actually does it when it's useful and not just constantly as a party trick, which I feel is, I mean, really, Quaresma can drive you mad because he goes for the trivello and it just doesn't make any sense at all. Whereas Modric is someone who applies it and uses it to find improbable angles. I mean, there was an act of perversion, that cross, Max. It was something that shouldn't be on public television. It was a shape that was frankly obscene.
It's kind of mad that Real are in the semis, Baz. Given this game and PSG, they've probably been, over those four matches, the better side for about 60 minutes, I think. I'm trying to think. They were the better side for most of the first half against Chelsea in the first leg and a tiny bit of the PSG game. Yet they are still here. They're still in it.
Yeah, well, I think it's a thing Sid says regularly. They always find a way, except occasionally when they don't find a way, but they generally always find a way. And I'll be honest, I quite fancy Chelsea to overturn the deficit and go through last night. I invested a few pennies on it at quite a double figure odds, and I thought I was going to be in the money, but ultimately they came up a tiny bit short. And Real Madrid, while they made life difficult for themselves, found a way.
And Ancelotti, Sid, is interesting, isn't he? Because we don't really talk about him that much. Is that because, you know, he's a pragmatist? We don't really have Ancelotti ball, and he doesn't really make it about him. He's just sort of pretty chilled about the whole affair, really. Almost like if they... He looks, after the game, when the camera focused in on him, you wouldn't have known if Real Madrid had gone through or gone out.
I mean, it definitely is true that he is, the way that he responds to what happens and the way that he talks about himself is definitely part of the reason why we don't, because you're right, he doesn't make it about him. He doesn't have, he's not kind of wedded to a particular style or a particular system that means that, and you know, we're all guilty of this, I suppose, as writers, that means that there's an obvious thing to associate him with. And therefore, as you say, there's not a kind of a look at this Klopp model or look at this Guardiola model. There isn't a thing that's Ancelotti that means you feel like Ancelotti is radically changing anything. I remember, I think his first autobiography was called The Christmas Tree, because he talked about how he'd come up with his formation to get as many sort of creative attackers in the team as he could. And obviously you had one at the top of the pitch and two just behind him. And then actually the line of three in The Christmas Tree was also mostly pretty creative as well. But that was also to do with the politics of the clubs he's been at. And of course, one of the things that Ancelotti's done really well is manage the fact that you've got pressure from below and from above when you're the coach, that you've got the owner. And in his case, he's had Abramovich and Berlusconi and Florentino and who else has he had? A whole load of really difficult people in charge, the PSG owners. And so I think that's part of it. He's very, very calm about things. I think that this version of Ancelotti at Real Madrid is kind of like Ancelotti, but more so. And one of the reasons for that is that, to be perfectly honest, Ancelotti didn't think he would be in this position again. He didn't think he would be back at Real Madrid again. He's at Real Madrid basically because of a chance telephone conversation when Real Madrid couldn't find a manager. And then there's sort of the penny drops during the conversation, which is about something else. Like, hey, you could do this. And it's like, yeah, all right then. And so you get this, I think, feeling with Ancelotti now that's like, bloody hell, I'm back at Real Madrid. This is fantastic. You know, nothing else really matters. And he talks about this really openly. And he was asked about the pressure the other day. And he was saying, you know, there's pressure at every club, but I'm at Real Madrid. I'm at Real Madrid. And that's kind of what he keeps saying. The other thing that, and Philip Lahm talked about it a little bit in the piece that he wrote for The Guardian yesterday. And I can't remember who it was. I think it was Casemiro a week or so ago, was talking about Ancelotti as a person who listens to players. And a lot of managers, all right, every manager does up to a point, but not a lot of managers kind of take that on in quite the same way. And he's just been brilliant this year. At the same time as, if you look at, and you've already said it with these two games against PSG and Chelsea, if you look at it from an analytical point of view, it's possible to argue with my statement that Ancelotti's been brilliant this year. You can say, well, actually, have they been brilliant?
Well, I think we talked about this when he was appointed, really, before the season, is that he seemed like a logical choice for Real Madrid this season. And I'm happy to be corrected by Sid if he has an opposing view. But just because if you look at the Real Madrid squad, there's very clearly a lot of outstanding players there. But it's a bit of a strange mix of players who are brilliant, but perhaps on their way down, players who could be brilliant, but perhaps aren't quite there yet. And is there, if he had someone who has a clear system and like an ideal way of this is how it must be, I think might have struggled to get the best out of the squad because it's like suboptimal in some ways. Whereas Ancelotti, his sort of very arch pragmatism and just sort of looking at what each game requires and trying to figure out a way of getting past the next opponents and just not being too bothered by everything seems perfect.
The other thing is that, you know, you don't look at Ancelotti, and I don't know if this is maybe unfair, it probably is unfair, but you don't look at him and say, this is a guy that's going to construct something new for you. More that this is a guy that's going to keep this thing moving at a time when, you know, decisions are going to have to be made in that midfield. And yet when it comes to it, for example, you look at that midfield, you go, all right, who are the three best midfielders? Well, the answer is Casemiro, Kroos and Modric. Even if you recognise that there's an element of that being problematic. So, you know, you have Valverde to do the running for them, and at Stamford Bridge it worked really well, less well yesterday. And actually, I think this has been overlooked and perhaps shouldn't be. One of the things that really changed the game in their favour in the two games at the Bernabeu was the withdrawal of Toni Kroos. And I hate to say it because he's a wonderful player, but it really helped them in both games.
Yeah, and the appearance of Camavinga, crucially.
Yes, I mean, in both cases, it was Camavinga for Kroos, yeah.
You look at this game from a Chelsea point of view, Barry, they almost played that game absolutely perfectly yesterday, didn't they?
Yes, I think Thomas Tuchel said afterwards they only made two mistakes and got punished for both. There was the Rudiger slip is the one that springs immediately to mind. That was for the Karim Benzema goal. And there's no doubt Chelsea lost this in the first leg when they played really badly at home and made far more than two mistakes and kept giving the ball away. And they'll be gutted over that, but they can be immensely proud of that performance last night. And with a little bit more luck, they could have gone through and it would be Real who'd be, you know, lots of finger pointing, I'm sure, in the Spanish media. But that is football. You know, often we've said it before, you can play really well in a game of football and still lose. And someone has to lose these ties, and they lost this at Stamford Bridge.
And I wonder, Lars, if it makes it more frustrating if you get it right tactically and lose. Like, Kovacic came in and had a really good game, didn't he? He's just a player that I haven't really watched enough, I think. I've watched him play loads of times. I've not really studied him. Werner stretched him. Rudiger was pretty immense. And I do feel sorry for Tuchel a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the story of the game is that Chelsea conceded two chances and Real Madrid took both of them. And when the situation before the game score-wise was what it was, that leaves Chelsea with just too much to do. Now, I think there's something about this. Like, I'm, as you know, I'm a cold, hard facts man. I don't believe in witches, curses. I don't believe in the hoodoos.
In romance or love or joy or...
No, none of this, not really. But
no,
I really do think there is something to the sort of self-fulfilling prophecy of Real Madrid going onto the pitch before this game and being in a situation where if they could go behind, they know they've come back before. They have this sort of institutional memory of these great nights at the Santiago Bernabeu and these sort of comebacks. I think you're more likely to be able to turn something around if you've experienced turning something around before. I think that is a real thing.
I think it's, As you know, I come back to this all the time because I always have this feeling with Real Madrid that somehow it's just going to happen, even if it doesn't seem very likely. And against PSG, it was the case, and it was the case this time. And you're right, of course, there's been plenty of times when it's not the case. I think you're right. There is something about knowing it And I think there's something about knowing it that's not just about Real Madrid. I think it's about the opponents too. And I think this probably was less the case with Chelsea, but it was definitely the case with PSG. You can feel that PSG were like, oh, bloody hell, here it comes. And the other thing, and again, I don't want to overplay this, but when you, it's very easy to be drawn into this. And, you know, for all the talk of systems and so on, footballers are humans. Well, most of them are. And you get this moment when the Bernabeu realises as well. And there was a moment last night, and I'm trying to think which one it was. I think it's when Courtois makes that incredible save that would have made it 4-0. And the whole place is like, all right then, here we go. and this is everyone, yeah, we can this is actually going to happen. And it happened, it sort of happened a little bit when the 3-0 was ruled out. I must admit, when the 3-0 was ruled out, I thought, that's it, Madrid win this. And then they got the 3-0. And you thought, oh, well, maybe not then. Then Courtois makes that save. And then once Modric had scored, and obviously, look, when we talk about...
He did, to be fair, he didn't score. It was worth a goal.
Rodrigo kicked in. But what, and you know, in all the analysis of all these kind of weird, sort of almost mystical things that seem to happen, part of the analysis is one man is incredibly good at kicking a ball. And Modric did it against PSG, and he did it again here to create the goals. But then when that went in, genuinely, I don't think anyone in the stadium thought Madrid weren't going to win it.
Yeah. Still on that third goal that was disallowed, Lars. I mean, I go to you, Lars. There's just someone to say, that's the raw.
Yeah.
It might be an arse, but that's what it is. Because I can't look at social media anymore when people are
The law is what it is. I mean, if anything, that law is a real triumph for the people who say all we want is consistency, because it's a totally consistent law. If any kind of contact with the hand before you score a goal, and it has to be disallowed, whatever the ref thinks, whatever the context, the law is completely clear. And it is in itself, I guess, a good example of why you really don't want a law to be totally consistent, because sometimes you do need common sense, because it was total bollocks. But it is what the laws say.
Sorry, Lars. I was going to say, here's a suggestion, and with your understanding of the laws, perhaps you can tell me whether or not this is nonsense. There was a suggestion last night that when the ball hits Alonso's hand, assuming it does, by the way, the replays look very much like it does, but I don't know if it might actually be his body, but it looks like it does, doesn't it? And when the ball hits his hand, assuming that he knows it has hit his hand because he can feel it, even if it only just grazes it, at that point, he should not shoot.
Yeah.
Because there's VAR.
Good point.
At that point, he should not shoot and he should look to pass it, because then it's not immediately leading to a goal.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, look, that requires a serious amount of cool-headedness in that kind of environment. But I wonder if here's another one. If he'd shot and it hit the bar or the post or something and come back to someone else to follow up the rebound, does that goal get disallowed, Lars?
No, I think they changed that. It used to be... I'm going to double check, but they had...
No, it would now count.
It was last year it wouldn't have counted. Yeah. This year it would have counted.
So there was still a way to rescue that move. There was, if he'd been aware, there was a way to rescue that move still.
It's a bit like in five a side, you know, when you're playing two touch and then you've taken two touches and then you have to stand around the ball and one of your teammates has to run and get a touch.
To kind of rehabilitate the move.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, despite all of this, Chelsea had so many chances. You know, Pulisic had those chances, didn't he, Baz? Tristan says, a couple of nice field goals from Pulisic tonight. I mean, and then in the last minute, like Havertz header, and then Jorginho, actually, once he's controlled that, you think he should really score.
Jorginho should have scored. That will haunt him, I think. They had three good consecutive chances in extra time. Ziyech, from a tight angle, when Courtois saved, and he should probably, you know, here's me telling Hakim Ziyech how to play football, but he should probably have squared the ball for Saul Niguez or well, maybe not Pulisic, given he'd have probably put it into Rose. Jorginho pulled that shot wide with almost the last kick of the game. He should have scored. I mean, contrast that with the coolness of the finish in the Villarreal game, which I'm sure we'll get to, that settled that tie. You know, these are the margins. But they had enough chances to go through, and with better finishing, they should have gone through.
But can I throw... it's worth throwing in Lukaku's header in the first leg here, isn't it? Because that was equally bad a miss as any of these, possibly even worse.
Absolutely. Thomas Tuchel complained that when he went to shake hands with the referee, he found the ref laughing with Real Madrid manager Carlo Ancelotti. I think this is very, very bad timing, and I told him that, the Chelsea manager said, after words had been exchanged.
Ancelotti is an incredibly funny guy, so this is just, you have to, if you've read his autobiography, he is an incredibly funny guy, so he's probably just told one of his many, many funny anecdotes. But you think it's a strange time for Ancelotti to be telling the referee anecdotes. They've just won the quarterfinal of the Champions League, but you know, he can't be stopped. He's irrepressible.
To be fair to Tuchel, he did say that. He said, I went over to the referee and he said, and I know that Ancelotti's a lovely guy. And so he actually said, I know. And you know, obviously, look, it's a nonsense really what Tuchel says, but I can understand that in that moment, you just think, oh, you bastard, you're just rubbing it in now, you know.
What's the amount of time before a ref cannot be totally stony-faced? If he's still holding the match ball, wherever he is, he's not allowed to exhibit any emotion.
You have to have left the stadium. You're not allowed, until you walk out the front gate of the stadium, you're not allowed to smile at anyone.
Yeah, even the assistants, even after the game, where they're going, good game, good game, and they're just staring at each other and they can't smile.
Who was that referee, Max? Sorry, I think it was in England, wasn't it? The referee that celebrates someone scoring. That famous bit of footage.
Mike Dean celebrated a Tottenham goal against Aston Villa, or else a Villa goal against Tottenham.
That sounds right.
Because he'd played an advantage and he kind of wheeled away in celebration, punching the air, got absolutely slaughtered for it. He has said since that it was a terrible thing for him to do, but he was celebrating his own contribution by playing an advantage rather than the fact that one of the teams had scored.
So long as he doesn't slide on his knees to the corner flag and pull his shirt off and point to the sky and everything. Or do the CU. He doesn't jump up and do the Ronaldo CU, then we're in real trouble.
If he'd been part of the catching a fish celebration, that would probably be taking it a step too far.
Well, he is due to retire from refereeing at the end of this season, so I wouldn't rule out an e-slide in the coming weeks.
That would be brilliant.
Absolutely tremendous. Just to send Burnley down, and then he runs off, puts his hand to his ear and goes, I've read a fucking good advantage there, lads. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Villarreal's brilliant win at the Allianz. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We have live shows, the UK and Irish tour, although sold out in Dublin. Ian says, hi all at Football Weekly. Just wanted to get in touch to ask for your advice regarding the forthcoming live shows. Due to the Manchester date falling very close to my 40th birthday and my main pod listening friend now listening on the other side of the world, my wife has volunteered to come along to the Manchester live show and keep me company for the evening. The only issue is she has no interest in football and has never listened to the pod, even asking, can I bring a book? After I'd purchased tickets. As such, can you give any advice or tips on what she can expect on the evening or how best to prepare? Maybe recommend particular episodes that showcase what this pod is all about, or possibly provide some frequently asked questions or put together some highlights so that she can feel part of many of the in-jokes we can expect on the evening. Many thanks for all your great work. My days walking the dog while listening provide a safe haven and calm respite from the world. I can't say how grateful I am for this. All the best, Ian. P.S. I'll try and get Claire to wave from row 12 if she can tear her eyes away from said book for some of the evening. Barry, can we just please make a mental note that Claire at the Manchester gig will be reading a book while we're doing our show?
I think Claire will be all right. I have a good mate who has no interest in football, thinks I'm an idiot, and he came along to one of our shows and was incredibly pleasantly surprised about the enormous lack of football content. So, and considering this tour is taking place during a summer in which there isn't much football, I reckon Claire could almost leave her book at home, and or else she could possibly come up on stage and do a reading from
That's
whatever.
A great idea. Myticket.co.uk is where you get the tickets from. So, they're selling out fast, or they're not. I don't know, but buy a ticket. So Bayern 1, Villarreal 1, Villarreal through 2-1 on aggregate. Archie Rintut joins us from Munich Airport. He shouldn't still be there, but that doesn't matter. He's there to talk to us. How are you, Archie?
know what you're talking about, Max. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. I'm pleased. Look, you were there. What did you make of that? Obviously, we really want to talk about how brilliant Villarreal were, and I thought they deserved that.
Yeah, let's do that. Because from the moment that Bayern drew Villarreal, there's a video which has emerged on Bayern TV with sporting director Hasan Salihamidzic, where the presenter chuckles along and goes, "So, I think it's a very manageable draw." And then both he and Salihamidzic chuckle a little bit. And I think that is definitely a vibe that you got from Villarreal, that they felt underestimated by Bayern. Dani Parejo also gave an animated interview last night where he was detailing just that, what they felt there. And look, did Villarreal have to employ what we diplomatically call game management? Or on the other hand, a bit of shithousery? Yes. But I think they should be lauded for the way they went about their business, because they are at a disadvantage to Bayern. And the fact is, it showed that you can be more than the sum of your parts. And in Bayern's case, you can be less than the sum of your parts despite having overwhelming individual quality and repeatedly slamming their heads against the door for 90 minutes. And over the course of the two legs, who created the better chances? Villarreal. It's simple. Bayern were stunned last night, Max. And it felt a little bit like being in a wake after the game, just looking at all the Bayern faces. But you contrast that and you see what it meant to Villarreal. I saw 10 minutes after full time, the Villarreal players all came back out again to celebrate with their fans, the 1,500 who had made the journey to Bayern. And Etienne Capoue was on some sort of FaceTime call, and I just saw him with one arm out, kind of wheeling around like he was some sort of five-year-old kid pretending to be an airplane. And you know what? I was like, you can't begrudge them this. This is an amazing story. And something about when the ball was rolled across to Chukwueze in the final minute, you were like, you know where this is going.
Yeah.
this is going in.
It was an amazing moment. Pete says, does anyone know what sort of size town Villarreal is? I've never heard it mentioned anywhere. this from the Canary says, what does this mean to the people of Villarreal? Could they actually make the final? It's wild stuff. I mean, Sid, I know you were at the Bernabeu, but this does actually, this is an incredible achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and that the town thing is well placed, because it's very difficult to get away from that part of the analysis of this. And I was writing about this last week and actually made that point that, you know, the isn't this a small town thing is wearing a little bit thin. But actually, it's a good idea to remind yourself of this, because it genuinely is extraordinary. If you go to Villarreal, and I try and choose my words carefully here, because it's very plausible that you upset people. It's not a place that you would go to, if you sort of mean. It's a sort of not particularly exciting town. The one cheat code to this is it is only 10 minutes down the road from Castellón, which is a provincial capital and is a big place, although Castellón has its own team and historically was bigger than Villarreal. The achievement is extraordinary, but it's also an achievement of kind of logic. So this is a club that was taken over, and there's quite a lot of Guardian articles actually about this before the final with Manchester United from last year. Taken over by Fernando Roche. The Roche family have been involved in sport in the Valencian community for a long time, the basketball team, Valencia Football Club. They have huge interest in the ceramics industry there. They're the owners of one of the big supermarkets in Spain. There's been a lot of money invested at the club, and invested very, very sensibly. So this is, if you like, shall I use that horrible word, a project. You know, it is something that's been done, structured very well. It's not come out of nowhere. It's been done with economic, really significant economic backing. But it's not just kind of throw money at buying big players. It's economic backing to build something. And so in a way, this is the result of logic rather than some sort of incredible, unbelievable story. But at the same time, it still is absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, the difference between them and Bayern is just gigantic.
Barry, you were really impressed with Villarreal. That goal, did Chukwueze scuff it, or did he intentionally kick it into the ground?
Well, you'd have to ask him that, Max. I don't think he scuffed it. You know, he hit it cleanly, but whether he hit it cleanly deliberately into the ground or on purpose or not, I that's for him to say. It was a fine finish under immense pressure very late in the game. And yeah, I was massively impressed with Villarreal. Look, they rode their luck a little bit. Musiala, Upamecano and Thomas Muller all missed good chances for Bayern. I thought Bayern should have had a penalty when the Villarreal goalkeeper, Geronimo Rulli, took out Musiala, wasn't given. He didn't get the ball, in my opinion. But not that's not to take away from Villarreal, because this wasn't a performance like a defensive performance like Atletico Madrid's last week. They were very clever against a massively attacking Bayern lineup, which had Leroy Sané and Kingsley Coman as wing backs. But you know, they didn't try and lump the ball into space behind them. They patiently and courageously, I might add, played the ball out from the back, strung loads of passes together, and never ever panicked, even when they went a goal down. And looked, you know, Bayern had the upper hand until Villarreal scored that winner. And you suspect if it went into extra time, Bayern probably would have prevailed. But it was a hugely impressive performance. And you, I can't get away from the fact that there's all these sort of Premier League, not even has-beens, but not quite ever-wers in this lineup who are, you know, Etienne Capoue. Spurs fans must be looking at Giovanni Lo Celso and just scratching their heads going, where the hell was this version of him when he was with us?
There's a brilliant tweet from Lars Sivertsen who said, Bayern going out to a team that has Lo Celso, Aurier, Foyth and Capoue on the pitch is 100% pure, uncut, unfiltered, weapons-grade banter. And actually, Lars, Thomas says, with your tweet in mind, could it be that the Premier League is only the second best league in the world, overshadowed completely by the ex-Premier League league?
That's possible. I mean, we did have the... To balance that out, we have had Stoke legend Erik-Maxime Choupo-Moting and West Brom icon Serge Gnabry on the losing side in this game. So, I mean, this can cut both ways. I just think Villarreal are an interesting example of people thriving in the right environment. You know, these are players. I mean, some of these players weren't magically good when they were in the Premier League just because they've done well for it. That's not how it works. It's just that some people are right for certain contexts, and I think that applies very much to the coach Unai Emery as well.
Will says, could I temporarily play the role of internet troll and ask whether the Bundesliga is colossally overrated? How many Bayern players would get into other top European sides apart from Lewandowski? A German team hasn't won the Europa since 97. In that time, Sevilla alone have 5 titles. It seems like a direct attack on you, Archie Rintat.
I think there's something to be said for how seriously teams have taken the Europa League, for example. And from a German perspective, that purely on reputation on where these teams are right now, that Borussia Dortmund were knocked out of the Europa League by Rangers. And in a fashion where they played terribly, particularly in that first leg, then the way that Bayern were not able, despite having as much of the ball as they did, to get past Villarreal, colossally overrated. I don't think so.
So what I would put to Archie, which might be a more sort of productive discussion to take, direction to take this discussion, I do watch quite a bit of the Bundesliga, and it occurs to me that almost no one can defend. And that seems like something that will hurt you in European knockouts.
It's ultimately because they've not been able to keep up with the amount of money which is swilling around in the rest of European football, and German football has not got that same source of income apart from Bayern. And because of the way that the Champions League money has come in continually, and the fact that Premier League mid-table clubs can now pay significantly more in this last decade, you've stopped seeing deals such as Ruud van Nistelrooy going to Hamburg, Raul going to Schalke. You see a better quality of player going to Premier League mid-table. I'm not saying that they would have gone to Fulham and West Brom, respectively, 10 years ago. But the point is that the Bundesliga is struggling to compete on that level. They've been really badly hit financially by the pandemic. And I see where Will is coming from at certain point. Because also the problem is that you've got lots of clubs that no traditional football fans really care about in German football doing well. And that doesn't really help when you've got RB Leipzig plowing away, even Bayer Leverkusen to a certain extent as well. So look, it's a very complicated issue. What I'd say on Bayern is that they're in trouble. They have got a lot of uncertainty in front of them right now. And that was the case before the game last night. They've got the contracts of four big players all up next summer, Lewandowski, Neuer, Müller, Gnabry. And you look at their squad recruitment, you look at also Julian Nagelsmann. His decision with the tactics to go with the system that he did, he's started playing Leroy Sané back on the right-hand side, and he already solved that equation at the beginning of the season. He works better on the left. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where the mud is thrown after this result.
Well, I would venture to say the short answer to listener Will's question is that looking at the Bayern Munich lineup, every single one of them would get into an elite European team elsewhere.
Do you know, I was going to ask Archie if did Bundesliga fans look at the Premier League and go, I wish we didn't have the 50+1 rule, and I wish we just had, you know, evil magnates from wherever with buckets of money?
They say the complete opposite of that. They say, in no case, there is nothing that could happen in which I would want to see 50+1 fall for that to happen. Because in Germany, it is more important what you stand for. It is more important about where your money is coming from. You see that with the amount of protests there are when the active fan scene, the ultras, are back in the stadium. And that is the thing that they are battling against. It's why it's such a great story that Eintracht Frankfurt are playing Barcelona in a European quarterfinal right now. And because they've done that through natural means as well. They've not effectively found a loophole with the rules a la RB Leipzig. And they're not, it's doing it in the way that everybody generally does in German football. So there was a clamour from people who would invest to break 50+1, but not in terms of from fans, not at all.
Archie, thank you so much. Have a safe flight. We'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Max. Cheers.
And before we say goodbye to Sid, Atleti City tonight. Can you put a case forward for Atleti getting through this, or do you think how good a chance do you think they have?
They're in a position that is not too bad from their point of view. I think, as Simeone suggested yesterday, they're not going to go mad looking for this. They're not going to change dramatically from what they did in the first game. They will still, broadly speaking, I think, try and be relatively defensive and relatively cautious and not necessarily go all out for the goal, but hope that the goal comes. Obviously, if they reach 60, 70 minutes and they're still chasing it, then they will. I've got a reason why Atletico Madrid will go through.
Yep.
And let's go back to the very start of the pod. Somehow Real Madrid always find a way. And if you look back at Real Madrid's recent Champions League history, the common denominator is they always meet Atletico Madrid and always beat Atletico Madrid. No one in the world wants Atletico to go through tonight more than Real Madrid do, to keep that symmetry and that inevitability about it going. Because if they get Atletico Madrid, they will win, and they will win the European Cup. Because that's just what happens.
Sid, you may go.
Thank you. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe there out in Madrid. And that'll do for part two. Part three, Nick Ames will join us. He has been at Dynamo Kyiv's first game since the illegal invasion of Russia into Ukraine. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Nick Ames, who is in Warsaw. Hey, Nick.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Now, look, you were at Dynamo Kyiv's first game since the illegal invasion of Ukraine. They played against Legia Warsaw. They won 3-1. I presume the result isn't the most important part of this story, is it really?
It's not the most important part, and I must admit, although I was in the stadium, I did not see a lot of the game. I had a press pass, but I quickly dispensed with that and went in with some of the thousands of Ukrainians who were here at the game in Warsaw, because obviously we're only 100, maybe 120 miles from the border, and there are many both Ukrainians who live here already, and obviously thousands and thousands of refugees who have come here. So I half watched the game with some of them and listened to a few of their stories and tried to get a sense of how they were feeling, both more generally and about being here.
And what was that sense? Did this feel symbolically important to the Ukrainian fans?
Yeah, it did. I think for some people there was the diversion element of, you know, doing something that felt a bit more normal and seeing them. Dynamo Kiev, I know we talk a lot about Shakhtar, but Dynamo is the most famous Ukrainian football club, quite representative of a lot of the nation. And I think there was something good for a lot of people to see their team play and be out there contesting a football match. But I think for many, it was a case of getting together. There was about 18,000 people in the crowd, I think. And I would say at least 2/3 of those were Ukrainian. I've never seen more women and children in a crowd before in my life, because to explain, most of the refugees who come over the border are women and children, because men under 60 cannot leave unless they are the father of three children, more or less those are the rules. So there were many, many tickets given to women and children in here. And, people enjoy the game, especially as Dynamo won, and from what I saw, played some really impressive football for a team that has been through what it has been through and not been training that long. But this was more about the collective experience, I think.
I just wonder how people were like with you. Were they very willing to talk? Were they keen to talk about, you know, their experiences and what they've been through? Because sometimes it can be actually not what you want, is to talk to a journalist when you're sort of trying to have a, you know, get together with your people, I guess.
Yeah, it varied. You have to move around in a very discreet way and just sort of get a sense for someone who may or may not want to talk in a bit more depth. I speak a little bit of Russian, but quite a few people aren't that keen on speaking Russian at the moment if they can speak Ukrainian for obvious reasons. So you have to take the temperature of that. I mean, for example, I'm writing a piece now that will hopefully have gone out by the time this does, but I was talking to a woman named Oksana at exactly the time that the third goal went in for Dynamo, and she was telling me very sadly about how some of her friends were killed in Bucha and found in a mass grave with signs of being tortured, and spoke about it in a very matter of fact way, saying she's just going to have to process it later, which is something that maybe we can't imagine at this point. But yeah, so it was a case of hearing stories like that. Also hearing from people, yeah, how happy they were just to see their team out there. And, you know, the moment when the Ukrainian anthem was sung at the start of the game and the crowd all held up blue and yellow placards, it was definitely one of those sort of spine-tingling moments. People were singing it and, you know, there was, if you looked around, there was a lot of emotion, a few tears, that kind of thing. So yeah, it was a real mixture of feelings and sensations and stories. I think it was, I mean, you're at a football match, but you're not at a football match. You know what I mean? When I was talking to Oksana, certainly the third goal was going in. We were standing quite near the corner flag, near the front at one end, and the third goal was going in down the other end, and it felt like it was happening in another country. You know, it was just, you know, seemed a very long way away. But I think it's fantastic that that Dynamo are able to do this, and they're raising a lot of money for the effort against the invasion. The money that was raised from the game will, I think, go straight to the refugee response here, which has been vast in Poland. And Poland obviously has opened its doors and been extremely accommodating and helpful to its neighbours. So, you know, I think only good has come of what happened yesterday.
And Shakhtar played a game against Olympiacos, didn't they, in a friendly that was on Saturday, and the money went to support refugees as well in that one. Just moving away from this, the coach we spoke to, Mladen, wasn't it? He's a Croat who now lives in Dnipro. I just wondered if you have heard from him, kept in touch with him at all, because at the time we spoke to him, there was, you know, it was very quiet in Dnipro and it isn't as quiet now.
Yeah, I text him about once a week just to check in and say, hi, how are you? In fact, I haven't done yet this week, so that's a good reminder. But the last I heard at the end of last week was that definitely the situation in Dnipro, where the airport has been completely bombed and areas around it as well, the situation is worsening, but him and his family were safe and at this point not going anywhere. And obviously, his team are not training. Football is very, very far from their minds. But yeah, happy to report that Mladen is, in relative terms, safe and well.
That's good to hear. Nick, look, important work you're doing. Thanks so much for coming on, mate.
Cheers, Max.
Nick Ames there, out in Warsaw. Moving back to footballing issues, Manchester United have apparently reached an agreement in principle with Erik ten Hag to become their next permanent manager, according to The Athletic. He verbally agreed the framework of a deal on Tuesday after RB Leipzig had sounded out the 52-year-old with a crazy offer at the weekend, whatever that means. So United's panicked and offered him a 3-year contract, includes the option for a 4th year. That's the news that we currently have. Lars, if you were Erik ten Hag, what would you do?
Ooh. So that's a really interesting way of putting that question, Max, because I think obviously there are reasons why, if you're a manager who's in demand, you might want to think twice about going to Manchester United, because it is a club that in recent years has looked, you know, borderline unmanageable. Louis van Gaal, of course, voiced his opinion about it being more a commercial club than a football club and how it wouldn't be suited to Ten Hag. I think what's sort of been leaking out from this process is that he's been quite keen on, I mean, certainly reports suggest that he's been quite keen on getting reassurances that he will have control over which players come in and which players go, which I think is very important because this squad does seem like a strange mishmash of players who are maybe not suited for any particular style, and that's going to be a challenge for him. I think at the end of the day, do take the job, no? Because it's Manchester United and you'll get paid a lot of money. And if it goes wrong, you can always blame the club for being a basket case. So, you know, why not?
That was the point I was going to make, Barry. Do you think it's got to a stage with Manchester United now where if you went as a manager, a promising manager with a good track record, and it went badly, you could just say, listen, it's nothing to do with me. Like it's almost gone so far that it's almost a free hit.
I think it depends on who you are, Max. Ten Hag has no experience of managing in one of the big leagues, inverted commas, although he does have experience of playing against elite teams from those leagues and doing quite well against them. So I think if he went there and it went disastrously, which is quite possible and may not be his fault, he possibly would suffer reputational damage, where if Carlo Ancelotti went, he wouldn't. So that would be my view. If I was him, I wouldn't take the job. I honestly wouldn't. And not as my first job at I'm not saying with respect to Ajax, but an elite club in an elite league. But I am absolutely fascinated to see how it turns out for him, and I have a feeling it won't go particularly well.
So I spoke to Football Weekly old-timer Michel Jongsma last night about this. You know, notable Dutch head Michel Jongsma, who knows about these things. And he was quite lukewarm on Ten Hag to United, just because, not because he doesn't rate Ten Hag, but just for the reason that it's such a complicated club, the expectations are super high, and there's a team that needs a lot of work there. And, you know, will you get the time to actually shape it into something, or will people kick off immediately? And that seems like a big issue. Also, with the type of coach he is, the type of football he believes in, a lot of the things that the players seem to not want to do under Rangnick, they will also be asked to do under Erik ten Hag. Like, there are very few sort of modern, ambitious football coaches who don't want their teams to press. Like, this is how most teams play. Yet the Man United player seems quite insulted at the sort of at the idea that they're going to have to run around a lot more than they're used to. And I also wonder, I mean, you know, they didn't like Mourinho. That's fair enough. No one likes Mourinho after working with him for a while. But, you know, they were suspicious of Solskjaer's credentials. They're apparently suspicious of Rangnick's credentials. Like, are anyone really good enough for this Man United squad? Do they just need to get binned off, like all of them? Just sell a lot of people and start again? Maybe it's a sort of scorched earth thing would be the way to go.
Now, you will have perhaps seen the quotes from the Northern Ireland women's manager, Kenny Shields, after England beat them 5-0. In the women's game, I've noticed, as I'm sure you're aware, if you go through the patterns, when a team concedes a goal, they concede a second one in a very short period of time, right through the whole spectrum of the women's game, because girls and women are more emotional than men. So they take a goal going in not very well. I mean, it's quite extraordinary quotes, even if you sort of misguidedly had that quite 1970s view of the world.
Or if you've ever watched any men's football, it's like, yeah, no, these guys are certainly not emotional. I remember watching point. Like Rudiger after full time yesterday thinking, here's a guy who's got the cool balanced head, definitely no emotions here.
Cause like Craig Bellamy was always pretty chill. Yeah. Sammy Kafur wasn't that bothered after that Solskjaer goal in 99. It's a very good point.
Yeah, so I think this is actually not about women's games at all. It's just about Kenny Shields never having watched men's football, which I guess maybe that's fine. I don't know.
Well, Kenny, I have to choose my words carefully here. Kenny Shields is an old man from a very small town in Northern Ireland. And as someone who knows a lot of old men from small towns in Ireland, I can safely say there are a lot of them who probably hold similar views. But it is very disappointing to hear someone who presumably spends a large amount of his time working with these women express the view, and that he, you know, we were quite on the pod before your time, Max. We were quite dismissive of women's football, and I'm embarrassed by that now. But we're learning. Or I certainly am, and I watch it quite a bit now, and I like listening to Susie and others talking about it. But yeah, poor from Kenny. And I'd be very interested to know what his players will make of those comments. I mean, Northern Ireland's women's football team, to the best of my knowledge, are part-time. They lost 5-0 against a professional outfit with far more resources, player-wise, money-wise. That's no shame on them. I remember the last time they played England in a friendly after a pandemic, they got battered and several of their players couldn't play because they couldn't get time off work. So I would say losing 5-0 against England is far from a disgrace for Northern Ireland's players. I didn't see the game, so I don't know whether they were all clutching their pearls and waving handkerchiefs. So, but I'm guessing they probably didn't.
Susie's on tomorrow, so we'll get more on that. Gareth says, with reference to all your swearing on the last pod, Lars, which was great fun, did Lars think last week's episode was the Christmas special where you all get drunk and say what you really think? We've got these on the subject of pub graffiti. Got sent some great photos. Johnson says, I saw this in a Brixton bar toilet, one of the best I've ever seen. And it says Roy Division. It's got a Joy Division album, but they just put Roy's face on that. And Tom said, I'm not sure if you're still doing toilet graffiti. I saw this sticker in Kingston Rugby Club toilets a few months ago. It just says, rhythm is a dancer. Jeff Schlupp is the answer. Jeff Schlupp dancing. And slightly more industrial from Siam Potter, written on the toilet door in Hanoi, Vietnam, fuck Troy Deeney. I mean, I don't know what Troy particularly had done.
It's enormously specific.
Just written in marker pen. So a bit less attention to detail with that one. And Ian says, I just listened to Monday's pod. Surely a t-shirt with a picture of Barney in a Fonzie thumbs up pose with the tagline, Kulusevski bro would sell bundles. We'll add it to the mix. Well, we got through a lot in that one. We'll do it again tomorrow, but for the time being, thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you in absentia to Archie, Sid and Nick. We'll be back tomorrow. Today's pod was produced by Silas Gray. The executive producer was Christian Bennett. See you tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.